Brian pulled me aside and said, Chip, you're our modern elder. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I like that. He said, well, a modern elder, Chip, is not just someone who's old. It's not like an elderly person. Elder is a relative term. You know, you are twice the age of the people here. So you're an elder amongst us. But what makes a modern elder different is they're as curious as they are wise. And when he said that, I was like, oh, wow.
So it was late 2019 when I learned that I was gifted the opportunity to be a keynote speaker for HSMAI, which is, for those who don't know, the Hospitality Sales and Marketing Association International. And I call up my buddy Stan Bromley. And if you know the Bromley name, Bromleys are like Four Seasons. Like, there's a whole tree of them. Mark Bromley's there now. And I'm talking to Stan. I'm just trying to get some insight on this audience. And Stan's like, you got to talk to Chip Conley. And I'm like, who's Chip Conley? He's like, you don't know who Chip Conley is? Go look up Chip Conley, which is very Stan, by the way.
It is.
And he ends up introducing me to Chip. And like, and I got to tell you, Chip, at this moment in time, it's pre-pandemic days, which feels like a decade sometimes ago. And you were gracious enough to give me a half hour. And I'm like, Chip, like, what am I stepping into? And it was, I remember it being a quick conversation, but a meaningful one. I was actually, to be honest, this is a courageous podcast. Like, I had a little fear going into that call. I remember listening to your audible of your book to be really ready to talk to Chip. And it's cool to go, like, you're on your journey, I'm on my journey. You're doing some amazing, amazing things with Modern Elder Academy. You've done, I mean, gosh, for those who haven't studied Chip's background, I mean, just amazing work in hospitality. And then you get an opportunity with Airbnb. I'm cutting corners here just for the spirit of time. But like, let's go back, because we're going to cover all that. Like, let's go back to like, before Chip Conley is Chip Conley, you're just Chip, right? Like, what was it like growing up being Chip? Like, where'd you grow up and how did you happen?
Well, how did I happen? We'll have to ask my parents about that. But they're still both living. My dad turns 85 next week, and my mom's turning 85 in January. But
wow,
I was their first child. They were both first children in their family. So you can see that I was probably hyperactive, responsible, having been the firstborn of two firstborn, both of whom went to Stanford. And being Chip was being a chip off the old block. I was Stephen Townsend Conley Jr. My dad was Stephen Sr. And my dad was a Marine captain, so he was a pretty hardcore dude. And at times I shrunk in his presence because he was really old school, very by the book kind of guy. And I was more of a creative person. And I was an introvert when I was young. And then at some point around early adolescence, my parents told me, like, Chip, if you don't do a better job of making friends, I'm going to send you to therapy. I was like, oh no, therapy. That sounds like jail. I had no idea what therapy was, but didn't sound good. And so in my teen years, I learned how to become a social alchemist, a mixologist of people. And I say that not to say that I'm not a genuine person, and or that this wasn't like the introversion piece of me was still there. That's part of the reason I've written 5 books, because I like to write, and writing is a very solitary task. But long story short is my early upbringing in Southern California was as this person who went from being an introvert to an extrovert, was very achievement oriented, and went to junior high school and high school in the inner city. I went to Snoop Dogg's high school. He's 10 years younger than me, but bottom line is, like, I was the curious white boy in my high school. So I learned a lot. And then I went to Stanford, undergrad, and I went to Stanford Business School. And that'll take you up to about the time I started my first business.
Let's talk about the books real quick. When you write, what's the process look like? Is there a time limit? Like, you've done this long enough to know how long it probably takes you to write a book. What's your process like, and how long does it take?
Well, the process is sort of interesting. It's like a pregnancy. There may be a romance going on with an idea, but from the point when I decide I'm going to write the book, it's 9 months. It's a process of about 9 months. I've done it faster, but you know, I also done it a little slower. So 9 months is about the average. And I tend to research my books. My books are not just Chip flowing his own prose about my life. It's also, you know, the books are really at the intersection of psychology and business. I tend to write well early in the morning. I say that my writer wakes up before my editor, meaning when I wake up at 4:30 in the morning and I'm just writing for 2 or 3 hours, there's no filter. It's just like me flowing. Whereas as the day goes on, there are more distractions and my editor kicks in a big way. And what does that mean? It just means that I don't like just flow it out. Like I can edit it later, you know, in the morning. But if I'm trying to write at nighttime or in the afternoon, not as good, because I feel distracted more, plus it's more labored. These ideas come to me along the way. The last book was called Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder. And that became my story of what it was like to be, you know, the old guy at Airbnb 10 years ago when the founders asked me to come in and be their mentor. So I wanted to write about it. And each of these books I've written has had it's got a strong personal story, but then it's got a foundation of intellectual and sort of thought leadership to it that is meant to be helpful to the reader. So it's not just a memoir.
Yeah. I'm taking notes in my mind. Cause you know, I've only written one book. I'm nowhere near five, but like I'm starting to process the next one. And I'm sure you feel the same way. Like you can spend your time many, many ways, right? So if you're going to write a book, it better be interesting to you. You got a passion for it. If you're going to give up, to me, the baby is born, but then you have to nurture for the baby, let the world, you know, it's like, there's a lot more work to be done after the 9 months of writing. I felt like mine was more like a documentary. So huge heads nodding when you talked about there's a research component and then the writing component. What's last book question? Like, what is your favorite part about the process? And then what is the part that just drives you mad?
Well, I'll start with the part that drives me mad. The part that drives me mad is publishers. I mean, as Seth Godin, a good friend of mine I went to business school with, said to me long, long ago, he said, Chip, if farmers treated their cows like publishers treat their authors, they would never get any milk. The farmers would never get any milk. It's not like the publishing, it's not the people are the problem. The people are great in the publishing industry, but the industry is sort of broken. And it takes way too long to get a book out. They have cut back so much on what they do that you're doing your own PR. I've had New York Times bestseller. I've had Wall Street Journal bestseller. I mean, I've had a lot of success in writing, but it's tough. In terms of what I like the most, I love the fleshing out of an idea, you know, something that feels like a little kernel and it's like the early stages. And I feel like it's something that hasn't been done before. So it's a topic and a way of a point of view on it. And maybe even a framework, my book Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow. That's a framework. I mean, that is, you know, I'm not a consultant, so I don't like live in that world, but that book is a practitioner's guide that has a very much a consulting model that any company could use. And so, that's what I love.
I mean, I thought your writing was super thoughtful. Like you step into the shoes of the audience. I'm like, yeah, I can. That's what you want to do. Like slow down and in some ways hold the hand of the audience and be practical about it. And I always talk, it's funny because I do say I'm a consultant still. I like consulting. It does mm-hmm. bother me. Like when I'm being asked to go on a stage somewhere and like someone's written a book and they've lived their ideas in the land of theory. And you're like, well, right. Where's the practicality of that? Like, right. Did they ever bring that to life? And so I love the way that you're thinking about, hey, is this really practical? And you've done this for a long time. It's not like, yeah. I mean, and I mean that in the best possible way. I actually was like, I'm like, how's he going to respond to this question? Like, do you see yourself as a hospitality guy that gets marketing or a marketer who understands the importance of hospitality?
I would say I'm a marketer who understands hospitality and I'm deeply connected to hospitality, but I love to zeitgeist surf. So, you know, being a zeitgeist surfer. And if you're a zeitgeist surfer and you're sort of like imagining something that hasn't been done before, whether it's a certain kind of boutique hotel or creating the first boutique campground in the United States and things like that, you know, the Modern Elder Academy, the first midlife wisdom school, you know, I was one of the first boutique hoteliers. I just love that. I love having a premise and then being able to go out and prove that it works. And it doesn't always work. I have had restaurant concepts that just were, seemed like a great idea, but either the idea was faulty or the execution was, and it didn't work. So, you know, but you learn from those as well.
Those are so terrifying, aren't they? When you're like, I have a hunch and I think I have enough data. I mean, same thing. Like, I'm selling courage. I mean, really? Like, to some corporations, like, the last thing they want or think they need, they're just trying to get through the weeds of their emails, right? Like, right. Courage, like, how does that play? So I've definitely had that feeling. Like, is this, am I on the right path?
Yeah. It's a hard one. You know, Seth, my friend, Seth Godin wrote a book called The Dip. And The Dip was this element, and I haven't read it in ages, but it was the idea that you have an idea and you get it out there, and it might have some initial positive or not, but there's a dip at some point. And it's in that dip that you have to understand whether this is a fad or a trend, a short-term fad, long-term trend, whether this idea has a robust long-term future ahead of it. And it's hard because, you know, there can sometimes be pieces of evidence along the way that suggest maybe you're on the wrong path. And that's why, you know, feeling like you have a calling, you know, if you take our relationship with work and put it into a pyramid, it'd be job at the base of the pyramid, career in the middle. And at the top, at the peak of that pyramid is a calling. And when you feel like you're living your calling and you're pursuing a purpose that feels noble and like you're in the middle of your ikigai, you know, the idea of like, what do you do? What do you love doing? What do you do well? What can you get paid for? And what does the world need? And right in the bullseye, then that's when you have to sort of say, I have to be patient. Sometimes you have to, I'd be patient and persistence. It's a combination of those two.
Job, career, calling. And I think the older you get, the closer you get to calling, right? Like,
yes.
The early days, if you figure this out before me, bravo. And I'm not, I just think when I got into ad agency life at like right out of school, and it was survival mode. You know, you're not totally sure who to trust. You're trying to trust, you trust everybody, of course. You want to please everybody. You want to prove that you belong. You don't know anything. You think you know everything. And it takes a while before it slows down. And, you know, we're going to get to Airbnb here in a hot second. But I'd love to know, like, along the way, when you think about the mentors that you ran into, and of course, mentors are a funny thing because when you run into them the first time, you're not like, ding, mentor. But like over time, like, oh, wow, like if I really step back, that human really helped me. Did you have like a mentor or a few in business that you just turned to and loved?
Let me tell you, the mentor that was most meaningful to me was a guy from Dallas named Herb Kelleher. So for 37 years, he was the CEO of Southwest Airlines and one of the co-founders. And long story short is, about 3 years into me starting Joie de Vivre, my boutique hotel business that grew to 52 hotels around California, I was seeing that, oh man, the thing we need to really, I need to really understand and we need to invest in as a company is culture. You know, as Peter Drucker said, culture, you know, eats strategy for breakfast. And so I wanted to say, like, well, who is a business leader that I really admire that I can learn from? And there wasn't anybody that came to mind in San Francisco. And then I just realized, you know, Southwest Airlines is this fascinating little company that has an amazing culture. So I called Dallas one day. This is, you know, 1991, I believe. And my company was 4 years old at that point. And I got a hold of Herb Kelleher's assistant named Colleen Barrett. And Colleen was so nice to me. She said, well, Herb can't be your mentor. I'm sorry. You know, he's a little busy. But she did say, what if you wrote a letter to Herb? And if you really build a rapport with Herb, you know, maybe he'll like just answer your letters when you write him. So I wrote him, asked him a bunch of questions on culture. 3 weeks later, I get a letter back from the chairman and CEO of Southwest Airlines answering my questions. And he said at the end, you know, I really like the questions you asked because some of them made me think about how do I see culture? And he said, you can write me once a year. And so for 10 years, 10 different letters. I wish I'd saved them all. Oh, man.
That's a book there.
Actually, I did save them all. And then one day, they all were thrown out because they were in a box of things that looked like it was trash. So I lost all 10 letters. I mean, I have some notes of like what I remember him saying, but long story short is, this is an example of like, okay, mentorship is not necessarily somebody who works with you or someone who lives near you, especially in the Zoom era. You can have a mentor from afar very easily. But it also was a real tale of Herb Kelleher. Funny thing about him is that that woman, Colleen Barrett, who was his assistant, ended up becoming president of Southwest Airlines because he deeply believed that she was better than he was at culture. So, you know, that was the part that was funny to me, is that over the course of time, I got to observe how this man took his executive assistant and built her through the ranks to the point where she was the first woman president of an American airline.
Plus, I'm sure there's immense trust between the two of them, right?
Like, oh, totally. So yeah, much.
And how important is that? Like, if no trust, good luck, right? So, man, that would have been, I don't know if you heard me stumble into that, but I'm like, that would have been a great book, like 10 letters, just in the responses back and forth. Maybe there's a, I don't know, maybe we'll come back with a quip. We'll do a podcast on that of what you remember in your notes, because I can only imagine the gems. So Airbnb, like, just wow. You know, it's funny, I always feel, I do take great pride in being an observationalist and like try to be a good listener. And one of my favorite interviews for Return on Courage was with a guy named Roger Martin, who was pretty high up in IP at Qualcomm. And he was going, you know, you look at Qualcomm, 30,000 employees, campuses, always good to have campuses, right? Plural. And he's going house on fire moment. And they're, and he would say that there's zombies in the business, these slow moving things that come in and they're moving so slow, you don't think they would actually take down your business. And we all see them. Airbnb, clear zombie to the hospitality business, right? Like, oh, we don't have to worry about Airbnb, this concept. And, you know, let's stay focused on what we think is our competitive set. So take me, like, first of all, like, how do you land there?
Yeah.
And then what's it like? And did you know right away that this was something?
So here's how it all happened. So a couple of years after I'd stolen my boutique hotel company, I sold the brand and the management company. I continued to own a bunch of the hotels. I got this call one day from Brian Chesky. He's the co-founder and CEO of Airbnb. And he asked me if I knew about Airbnb. And I said, yeah, you know, this is 10 years ago. And I said, well, I'm a hotelier in San Francisco and you guys are based here. So of course I know a little bit about you, but I said, aren't you owned by Couchsurfing? And that really was not a good first line. Like, Couchsurfing was this struggling little business. It was sort of a nonprofit and sort of a for-profit, but it was struggling. And of course, Airbnb was at that time a tiny business, but it was growing quickly globally. And he said, well, can I come over to your house and tell you more about Airbnb? And he said, I'll take an Uber over. And I said, what's Uber? And this is way before the sharing economy was very well known. And he came in, we hung out for 3 hours in my backyard in my cottage back there. And I just was really impressed by what a curious mind he had. He, you know, young entrepreneurs, and at that time he was 31, young entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley are known for their hubris, not necessarily their humility. And I could see humility in him as well as I could see the hubris too. But more than anything, I saw a guy who really wanted to learn, and he wanted to learn from someone like me because he didn't know anything about the hospitality or travel industry. So I joined the company, and it was awkward because I was like, I was twice the age of the average employee in the company, and I'd never worked in a tech company before. So they were saying, using a language that I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And so, but after a few weeks there, and you know, when I had sort of at times felt like I got to leave this place because I am the stupidest person in the room. Brian pulled me aside and said, Chip, you're our modern elder. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I like that. He said, well, a modern elder, Chip, is not just someone who's old. It's not like an elderly person. Elder is a relative term. You know, you are twice the age of the people here. So you're an elder amongst us. But what makes a modern elder different is they're as curious as they are wise. And when he said that, I was like, oh, wow, that alchemy of curiosity and wisdom, that's really what I've always been. I didn't know if I was wise, but I knew I was curious. And that's really when I said, okay, I'm going to embrace this. And the people, I mean, a lot of my hotel industry people had no idea. They didn't know what Airbnb was. And then once they started to hear it, I mean, my first reaction to it was like, oh, that's not a very good idea. Like, you know, why would anybody still want to stay in someone else's home? But I was lucky that John Donahoe was mentoring Brian before I was. John's currently the CEO of Nike, but at the time he was the CEO of eBay. And eBay was sort of like Airbnb. It was a two-sided marketplace where, you know, people, instead of selling space like Airbnb, they were selling, you know, stuff that people had, and buyers and sellers. And so John said, listen, Chip, you know, Brian is a very curious person. He could learn a lot from you. And this company, Airbnb, will be worth more than eBay, you know, in the next 4 or 5 years. And I was like, that's crazy. I can't believe you're saying that. But, and then I also knew the two other non-founder board members, which was weird. And they were both hot to trot on it too. So I jumped in, even though I thought the idea wasn't all that good. But I also knew what my role was, to help take something that was a little quirky and weird and millennial-esque and learn how to take it to the mainstream. And that's really what I did. I mean, that was, you know, that was my job, was to help mainstream Airbnb. So, you know, people at all ages, all over the world, not just millennials on a budget who wanted to travel to one of the 20 biggest cities in the world, which was what they were doing when I got there. And there were a lot of other people. They would have succeeded without me, but they would have succeeded in a different way and maybe not as big as they've become.
So do you have like a, oh shit, this is something moment, or like when you see all these people that you value taking board seats and also like mentoring, like, okay, they see something, I value these people? Or was there also a moment in time the PR took it over? What do you think?
Well, it was about 3 or 4 weeks in when I was only supposed to be working part time, and it was clear I was working full time because they needed me full time. And so I had the oh shit moment around that time when I was seeing just how committed the hosts and guests, just how rabidly evangelical the hosts and guests of Airbnb were. And that was fascinating. So I, you know, because I was in charge of all the hosts globally, I was in charge of a few things, but my specific title was head of global hospitality and strategy, and then the mentor to the founders. But I really got to know the hosts and guests quickly. And I was like, wow, products like that have this kind of evangelism are like Apple and Southwest Airlines and Disney. And this is a company that, if they can get it right and mainstream the product, could be have the most loyal customers in the world in the travel industry. And the truth is, that is what's happened. But it was also seeing, the thing that was hard for me was like, how do you create a hospitality business where the people delivering the hospitality are not your employees? Yes, you know, when there's customer service needs in the company, we are that. But the people providing the service were entrepreneurs, you know, and, you know, sometimes like a widow who just had, you know, a bedroom down the hall from her. And so how do you make that widow the best host ever? And that, honestly, that was the most interesting, intellectually interesting time there. Is like, it's not about creating a bunch of standards. It's about creating motivational tools, carrots and sticks, that help people to live up to their potential as hosts, and help them, educate them, like what are some little best practices that they might not have known about. But at the end of the day, you know, we created a monster when it came to customer satisfaction, and a lot of it had to do with our review system. So,
I mean, I would have had wild anxiety, like coming from the service business. And like, by the way, your service, like, you look at your resume, it's not like the service business. It's like service elevation, right?
Yeah.
So there's, you have to give yourself permission to give up control. However, when the standards are so high, go back to the Bromley conversation, Four Seasons, there's a standard of service, right? Like, and so then you go into this world where you have to give up a little bit of that control, right? And yet it works because, I mean, I'm trying to go, it's like, you know, it's so hard to go back to, what do I really remember about life before Airbnb and trying it for the first time? My bar was so low. Like, what's the worst that could happen? It's terrible when I check into a hotel. It wasn't that. So I wonder if, like, okay, bar raised. Then it was like an iterative approach.
It was iterative for sure. And we had great data. I mean, you know, Airbnb is a tech company, so it's a data company. So the data was really helpful. the review process. If you think about the hotel industry, they outsource their review system to TripAdvisor, not intentionally, but generally that's where people, and so there's a disconnect. So we were able to have an in-house review system that helps so much in terms of how do we get people better and how do we, what are the metrics to understand a particular host and how good they are and where they need some help and how do we use technology to influence their sense of that. Now, how do we create a super host program that helps people to feel not on the host side, like I aspire to be that and there's a bunch of benefits to it. And on the guest side, it's a way to filter, to sort of say the paradox of choice of having like all these choices. Well, one of the ways I'm going to filter is have a super host. And so it was about psychology and business. And it was hard though, because, you know, I didn't know the language. They were talking languages and I had to, at 52 years old, suck it up and just say, okay, you know, I'm going to learn to be humble myself in terms of saying, I don't understand what you're talking about. When it came to, like, I never forget when about a month into it, I was in a meeting of engineers and I was supposed to be just the silent one in the corner observing. And finally the 25-year-old wizard running the meeting turned to me and said, Chip, if you shipped a feature and no one used it, did it really ship? I was like, well, that's like a philosophical question about the tree in the forest. But, you know, if you shipped a feature, I don't even know what that means. What does it mean to ship a feature? And now I understand it really well. But at the time, I had to be the dumb person who sort of said, I don't understand your lingo. So I ultimately, for me, it taught me how to become a modern elder. And that's a really important thing because we live in a world where we're living longer, power in a digital society is moving younger, and the world is changing faster. And those three variables have a lot of people, you know, 45 to 65, confused.
I mean, I'm 46. So like hearing the story, I kid you not, like you give me courage to like stay curious and go into spaces you don't know. And I do think innovation, originality is sometimes you're in a deep category and you leap to a different category. And it's like, wait, nobody plays by these rules here. Right. And it worked over there. What can I bring into this space? But I adore the modern elder story because I never heard that before.
Yeah.
And obviously that's gotta be the genesis of what you're in now. And man, you're in it. And you know, this is a show about Courageous Podcast and you've got the Modern Elder Academy. Can you share a little bit about what that is and how long you've been doing it?
Yep. So it's been doing it about 5 years. And it came out of my time at Airbnb when I said, you know, I was writing the book, you know, Wisdom at Work, The Making of Modern Elder. And I was doing it on a beach, in a beach home I had an hour north of Cabo San Lucas in Baja. And I went for a run one day and I had a Baja Baja. I had an epiphany. I was like, why is it that we don't help people in midlife understand how to reimagine and repurpose themselves in a world where they're living longer, power is moving younger, and the world's changing faster? So decided to create the Modern Elder Academy, also known as MEA, and the world's first midlife wisdom school that helps people to cultivate and harvest their wisdom and helps them reframe their relationship with aging and move in a direction toward learning how to move from a fixed to a growth mindset. And I didn't know what it was going to be. There was nothing like it out there. And now 5 years later, we have 3,000 alumni from 40 countries and 26 regional chapters. The courage is still there. I mean, I have to have the courage still because I don't pay myself anything, which is fine. I have the money to be able to do that. But it's also because we're still in major growth mode. And if I was making a big salary, that would be a drag on the business. And we've grown, like growing like gangbusters, but growth costs money. And I'm funding all this myself based upon having earned an enormous amount of stock at Airbnb. But there's times when, you know, especially even the name, Modern Elder Academy, is like, oh, that's like Modern Elderly Academy. It's for people in their 80s. No, no, no. It's like average age is 54. We've had people as young as 28 and as old as 88 come to the campus for a workshop. But the bottom line is that it's anything with the word elder and playing with the idea of midlife. It's like midlife has a bad brand. The only thing attached to it is crisis. And, you know, elder sounds like an old thing. And like anything related to aging, we have anti-aging creams. You know, it's like aging is not something you want to bet on. And yet what I saw, because I lost 5 friends to suicide, age 42 to 52 during the Great Recession, all men, was we need to help people through this midlife journey to understand how do they get to the other side of midlife and have a better and better life. And how that, and that's really what we've done. So you got to come down.
Oh, I'm in.
Ryan, you gotta come and do a workshop.
I couldn't be more midlife. So I'm in. And I honestly, like, I think like part of it is to your, like, just going through the, like, what's the best way to articulate it. I do think it is really lonely to be the leader. And by the way, leader doesn't mean of a company. You're leading a family. You know, you're trying to figure this thing out. And there's anxiety knowing you're actually going to live longer because you need more money if you're going to live longer. Now, and I would go as far to call it a clarity epidemic. So I adore like what you're doing. And yes, I am so in to come down and be part of it. I do wonder, like, is it midlife or midpoint?
Well, it's midpoint as well. So here's my new language for it. It's not a midlife crisis. It's a midlife chrysalis. Because if you think about the caterpillar to butterfly journey, midlife is the chrysalis. And, you know, it's a period of time where things were dark and gooey, but it's also where the transformation occurs, the renewal occurs, sets it on the other side of that chrysalis is the butterfly. And the U-curve of happiness, social science research is really fascinating on this. It's you know, when I had my midlife crisis at age 47, you know, I didn't have any data to look at and say, okay, well, yeah, I'm going through something normal. Maybe it's not a crisis, but maybe it's a low point in happiness. And that's what the U-curve of happiness research shows, is that people between 45 and 50, I'm sorry to tell you this, Ryan, between 45 and 50 is when, on average, your mileage may vary, people hit their low point in adult satisfaction. Great. And with each decade after that, it gets better and better. So there's a lot of reasons for that. We can unpack it if you want. But the bottom line is helping people to understand the shift that you're supposed to go through, you know, the transformation that is meant to happen in midlife. For many people, the reason actually it's so hard is because they're holding on to a success script that they almost inherited from their family or community or from the culture that they grew up in. And it's around midlife where you start to realize, you know what, I've been living this success script and it worked for a while, but it's not who I am. And then it's like, you now need to be the screenwriter of your own success script based upon a bunch of other variables that, you know, are a function of the pattern recognition and wisdom that you have collected in your life.
I mean, this sort of nicely rolls into your definition of courage, which, when we had a chance to talk a couple of weeks ago, you almost started our call with, and I was like, oh, like, it just taught me.
I don't even remember it. So what did I say?
You said core.
Oh yeah. Okay. That piece.
The age.
Yeah. So core comes from heart in French. So in Spanish, corazón. So there's an element of courage that comes from the idea of you putting your heart into something. And then I also love the fact that age is the second syllable, partly because that speaks to maybe something that we develop over the course of our aging, is how to actually tap into our heart to actually be more steadfast in the things we believe. And so courage to me is this combination of heart and the wisdom from pattern recognition that helps you to say, yes, I'm going to fucking stick my neck out and do something that, you know, may not be, you know, on the road, you know, that most people travel.
You know, you think about those 1500 days you mentioned, right? From 45 to 50, it's approximately 1500 days. I wonder if there's anything to, because people suppress their heart, right? We suppress it. We choose to compartmentalize shit. We choose not to listen to it. And maybe your heart's like, no, 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 no. Like that story you've been telling yourself, like, let's keep it real. I wonder if that's part of like you probably already have the stages of what's happening, right? But like, is it part of that where it's like, you're telling you, no, where should you go? Who are you really about? Yeah. And you have to get through that 1500 day period to catapult the next two or three decades, which you said we are happier, where there's more vitality. Is that, you think that's part of it?
Oh, there's so many elements to it. So we, you know, Carl Jung, the psychologist and Richard Rohr, the famous Christian mystic, who is nearby me here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. They both say that the primary operating system for the first half of your adult life is your ego. And it serves you well in certain ways, and then at some point it doesn't serve you so well. And it's around midlife where your primary operating system is meant to change from your ego to your soul. But what does that mean? It basically means where you go a little more interior and you actually tap into meaning and purpose more. And you're actually a little bit, maybe a rekindling of interest in religion or spirituality tends to happen during that time. But the way I like to articulate it is that in the first half of our life, we accumulate. Just like a caterpillar is eating leaves, just bulking up. So that's what happens in the first half of our life. We accumulate knowledge and friends and dating and relationships, and then a marriage potentially, and then children, and then responsibilities, and then bills, and then you name it. And you get to midlife with this accumulation that is actually weighing you down. It's like the baggage of your life. And it is in midlife where you actually have to learn how to move from accumulation to editing. And it's around midlife you start to edit. And we call it the Great Midlife Edit at the Modern Elder Academy. And it's a ritual that we do with all the people who come to our workshops. It's like, and it's really powerful because it's like, wow, I feel like I've been weighed down by all this baggage. And it's the exercise we do with people. It takes, about 24 hours, the first 24 hours that people are there, helps them to realize what is not serving them anymore. What do they need to let go of? And then what are they going to replace it with? And that's what happens, is that is sort of like a psychological shift when you realize that you don't have to do it the way you've been doing it the rest of your life. And that there may be mindsets and identities and ways of thinking and being or people in your life that you're really supposed to edit from your life. And that makes space for something else.
I guess I'm curious, why did you feel you needed to like make Modern Elder Academy? Like what I know the data's there. Yeah. I get the data, but like you had to manifest this. Tell me more.
Well, yeah. So my personal story, is that I had a bad experience in midlife and a good one. The bad one was I lost 5 friends to suicide between 42 and 52, but I was doing my own suicide ideation around age 47. I didn't want to be running this company anymore. I'd been running it for 22 years, ultimately sold it 2 years later after I owned it 24 years and I've been CEO. But I felt really stuck. And I felt stuck with my identity of what it meant to be the founder and CEO of that company and all of the great things I got from that. But it also was just, it was confining. I had a long-term relationship, romantic relationship that was ending. I had a foster son who's African-American who was going to jail or prison wrongfully. And ultimately, it was let out 8 months later, but that was a pain. And I was running out of cash. Long story short, is all that was going on. So I got to the other side of it. And then I had the positive side of midlife. And the positive side of midlife was what I experienced at Airbnb. Like, oh, wow. Same seed, different soil. I had all that seed of wisdom inside of me. But now I was planted in different soil. But in soil where I could really flourish and help these young guys take their little company. And so I believe that, midlife's it's a stage of life rather than a specific age, but it's a stage where you need to actually learn like this stuff's important to creating a second half of life, adult life that is worthwhile. If you're 54 years old, which is the average age of the people who come to MEA, and you're going to live till 90, you have as many years of adulthood ahead of you, 54 to 90, as you do behind you, 54 to 18. You're halfway through your adult life at age 54. Most of us don't think that way. But it's a very personal story in terms of, when I think of my friends, and one of my friends was named Chip. How weird is it to have a friend named Chip when, it's my name? And he was somebody I really cared about a lot. And his, but he just had deep, deep demons. His wife and 2 kids found him, he hung himself from the family tree when they came out in the morning one day. And I just wish MEA existed so Chip had seen that he had more options available to him. So.
You said there's 3,000 alumni. And I wonder specifically in the early days, I'm sure it's word of mouth with especially like your people, right? Like your friends.
Yes.
But then as you iterate and start to get the programming right, Do you have the data on like what percent are like, no, you're going, someone else is like, you need to go there versus I'm willing to surrender and I'm coming. Like, what's the percentage?
Well, the vast majority are doing it on their own accord. People are usually, it's volitional and their own choice. But the number one feeder for us, number two feeder is PR media. So being on a podcast like with you or Rich Roll earlier this summer or Tim Ferriss 3 years ago. I mean, these are that media or print media, et cetera, is great. But the number one thing that feeds us, you know, in terms of customers and people coming, students, is word of mouth from friends and family. And yeah, sometimes it's the word of mouth. Someone's seen an article in the New York Times about us, and then they give it to their husband who needs it. But often it's someone who's actually been an alum, and they go home as an evangelist, and they go and tell their friends, and their friends say, okay, that sounds interesting. Let me explore it a little bit.
I mean, man, you're in the soul business.
We're in the soul business. That's it's a really interesting way to describe it. I sometimes say there's a museum in San Francisco that's famous called the Exploratorium. And it's really the Exploratorium of the Mind. It's like a science museum that both adults and kids love. Well, we're like not the Exploratorium of the Mind, we're sort of the Exploratorium of the Soul. And yet we do it with intellectual ballast so that it's academics from Stanford, Harvard, Yale, and UC Berkeley have been our primary people who have helped shape the curriculum.
You know, about 10 minutes ago, you were talking about, you know, courage being sticking your neck out there and taking and going off the beaten path, right, when others don't. And, you know, I kind of feel like, yeah, you're talking about yourself. I mean, what you're doing, what you're building. And there's this famous proverb that fear and courage are brothers. And I like to say fear and courage are kin, better way to say it. And, yeah. You know, that means there's no courage without first fighting fear. And so, you know, what's keeping you up at night right now? Like, I'm sure you're fighting some specific fear that you're trying to shrink down.
I think, you know, we're going to grow from doing about 1,500 students per year to 12,000 students per year 5 years from now, based upon the new campuses we have opening in Santa Fe, much larger campuses, based upon our MEA online programs growing the way they've been growing. So to go from, you know, to basically do a 10x of our annual number of students is scary. The good news is our customer satisfaction is exceptional right now, and that's part of the reason we feel good. But our marketing engine needs to ramp up dramatically to be able to get to those kind of numbers, and that's a little scary. What makes me confident is that the product is so damn good that we know how. You know, we have people who've come back 7 times to do a weekly workshop, and it's different theme each time. And it's like, wow, that shows you something. And so I feel good about it, but I also feel a little bit scared because obviously there's always things like, oh, a recession, you know, we're a premium product. It's not an inexpensive thing. We do have financial aid and really focused on like allowing people to come who can't normally afford it. And so that's good. But you know, it's a premium product, and you go into a recession, and you start. And it's also very much of a discretionary product. It's not like something a person has to do. So, but I, you know, overall,
I don't know, man. If you told me I should buy soul insurance, yeah. I mean, I would be in on soul insurance, and you know, who wouldn't want to buy soul insurance?
I think that's the clip. That is the clip from this. We got to take that clip and put it into a
marketing. Hey, you're the marketer who knows hospitality, right?
Yeah, so no,
I'm going to follow your lead on this one.
Yes.
Yeah. So look, I got to think like, cause I was like thinking about my dad. My dad's 80 and he's got clarity of purpose. I'm not sure. Like, who am I to decide if it's the right clarity of purpose? He's a lawyer. He still works. He's seen too many of his friends. Just when they retire, they're tired and they're done. And thanks for playing. And so I think he's a use it or lose it guy. And there's still passion to put on a suit. Gosh, like, you know, like he's going into work. He's happy when he's working. Now, growing up, and he's much softer, by the way, today. So when you talk about your dad in the military. Yep. Now.
Same with my dad.
Okay. Yeah. So like, let's go back to that Chip who had military dad, who wasn't a soft then. And if that Chip is talking to this Chip, actually, let's start with this Chip talking to little boy Chip.
Well, this Chip would say, would quote Oscar Wilde, who said, "Be yourself, everyone else is taken." I think what I felt early in my life was that there was a path for me that my parents had sort of plotted for me, and that I just needed to be the best I could at that path. What I came to realize is that they had some great intention for me, but my path, I needed to deviate from it a lot more. And my definition of success was going to be different than theirs. But ultimately, some of the character qualities that I actually built during that time, even though they aren't serving me to be on the same path as my parents, but the sense of achievement orientation and integrity and being very relationship focused, these are things that I think I learned on the path they wanted me to be on. Ultimately, I was on a very different path than theirs. So I would just say to that young Chip, dude, you know, your parents have a lot to teach you, but it's your path and your humanity that you're going to be developing here.
I definitely felt like my parents had me on a path. And then I also remember some Jewish kid from outside of DC. And my first real girlfriend in high school was Mormon.
Wow.
I was getting no action. But that wasn't important to me. Like, I loved playing sports and she was fun and funny. And like, my friends were like, I'm trying to figure this out, but okay. I'm like, that's just cool. And I remember one conversation with my dad, and I kind of pressed like if I ended up part of the LDS church. He's like, it's your life. Like, do what you want. It's your life. It wasn't a throwaway. He meant it. And it confused me because I'm like, wait a minute. Is this a trick? Is this a trap? I thought it wasn't a trap. And I'm blessed. Now my mom might think a little differently, by the way, but like, I felt like they had given me enough to keep me going. And then it's like, okay, what am I going to do on this choose your own adventure called life? And I do wonder if that's part of this white privilege conversation too, because I've lived a privileged life to have options, you know?
For sure.
All right. If little boy Chip is sitting here, or boy Chip, whatever, you get to decide. Yeah. And you're like, yeah. All right, buddy, what do I need to remember? Tell me something I need to hear. You need to hear. What would it be?
I think it would be go out and have fun. You know, just play, you know, and the good news is that I know how to play hard and play well and enjoy myself, but I often get so wrapped up in my calling, and I do have fun in the calling. And as a CEO of this company, and any business I've been in, people have fun with me. That's for sure. I mean, you don't start a company called Joie de Vivre, which means joy of life, if you don't like to have fun. But the bottom line is that I don't give myself enough time to just completely take the break to go do that. I mean, I meditate every day. I've got the good tools and practices, but this summer I took some nice vacation time and was offline, you know, completely offline. No, not checking email at all for a week at a time. You know, a couple, two or three times. And man, do I get renewed by that? And I, as a kid, you do too. So often, you know, you find joy when you break out of the habitual world you're in and you look for awe. And, you know, kids are really good at exploring awe and wonder.
Do you bring their videos into your program?
Who's there? Which videos?
Like kids, like you're right. Like the awe and the wonder and the joy. And
we bring videos in the program, but not necessarily kids. We do have intergenerational workshops sometimes, and that's fun to have kids. And we've just launched something called Generations Over Dinner, which is a totally cool thing where you get five or six generations. It doesn't have to be family members, but it could be around a dinner table. And there's a series of questions that allows people to really look at how can we learn from each other across generations, you know. And sometimes it's the youngest person at the table who says one of the most curious and wise things. that actually just everybody looks at it and is like, wow, that makes so much sense.
Chip, where can people go learn a little bit more about MEA?
ModernElderAcademy.com or ChipConley.com is my for my personal side. And then we on social media, you'll find us there. But the place I do most of my posting, I have a daily blog called Wisdom Well that is fun, and I love it, and allows me to write a lot. And it's all about some of the themes of MEA. If you just do a Chip Conley Wisdom Well Google search, you'll find it. And you subscribe for free and you get a daily email from me. So you can find those on LinkedIn. My LinkedIn profile is pretty full of my perspectives and my Wisdom Well posts.
You and Godin are just like, it's not close to others. Like you guys are, it's funny that you went to school together. Yeah. Also, I'm curious this is a selfish question. Cause I have a weekly dose of courage. I'm trying just let me invade your inbox once a week, try to nudge you towards courageousness and then get out of the way. But like, do you post what you put on your email on LinkedIn too? Like today, I think you had, it wasn't longevity, it was short-evity.
Yeah. So I write the post and then it goes out by email to the, tens of thousands of subscribers we have. And then we take the link of that post and we put it, on social media. LinkedIn is the best place to find it, probably, but you can find it on Facebook. On the MEA Facebook private group, as well as the MEA Facebook page. Actually, I don't post it very much to my personal Facebook page. And we also post it on Twitter. So.
All right. So take us home here. When you think about just the experiment of life that you've been in, right? And you think about maybe three ways where you've been courageous, where it's enhanced your life. Can you share for the listener who's on their own journey, sure, like those insights?
So I think the first time I had to show that kind of courage we're talking about is when I was, I had a longtime girlfriend in college. We were going to get married and it just didn't feel right. And ultimately I came out as a gay man and I had to tell my dad, the Marine captain, that, I'm on a different path, Dad. And so that was the time I had to be courageous. I had to be courageous 2.5 years out of business school when I decided to create a boutique hotel company and pay myself nothing, call it Joie de Vivre, which is a weird name. And, ultimately everybody was telling me like, you don't know what the hell you're doing. But I had the courage to say, I think I can take my commercial real estate knowledge of just a few years time at that point and apply it to this new phenomenon in hotels, boutique hotels. And I'd say definitely courageous right now to, creating a product in MEA that's the first midlife wisdom school. And then these regenerative communities we've created, which are like an alternative to a retirement community. So yeah, I'm courage or stupid. I don't know what, but
I think it's courageous. Time
is the will tell.
Well, look, I can't wait to get down to one of the locations. I think I'm leaning international between you and me.
Baja's amazing, especially in the winter, dude. Nice place to come in the winter.
I will gladly come sell some soul insurance with you. You just tell me where to go. And Chip, thank you so much for sharing your story and for giving us an hour. And I know we'll stay in touch. Thanks, man.
Thank you, Ryan.